This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a college president responds to a controversial tax plan floated by Connecticut's House Speaker. And a new study shows that more parking may actually mean less money for cities. But first, Fort Hood in Texas has yet to fully recover from a 2009 shooting rampage that left 13 dead and more than 30 wounded. Then on Wednesday, this happened.
At approximately 1600 or 4 p.m. today, a soldier assigned to 13th Sustainment Command Expeditionary fired shots at individuals within the unit areas here, within the 1st Medical Brigade area, and the 49th Transportation Battalion area.
An Iraq War veteran, Army Specialist Ivan Lopez, had been undergoing treatment for depression and anxiety and was being evaluated for PTSD before he opened fire, wounding 16 and killing 4, including himself. The role of post-traumatic stress in the case of Ivan Lopez is unknown at this point, but it has been linked to the epidemic of suicides within the armed forces since the start of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. The question is, how do we better support our veterans who need mental health care or other supports? Now, yesterday in Hartford, leading experts on veterans' issues from around the region came together to discuss the state of veterans at a conference hosted by Community Renewal Team and organized by Middle Atlantic States Correctional Association and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. We're going to be talking about what we learned from that conference yesterday. And if you have questions or thoughts, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. If you'd like to talk a bit or ask a question about how we support our troops, you can also email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive, and we're online at WNPR.org. I want to welcome in Chris McCloskey, Vice President of Housing and Community Services at the Community Renewal Team. Chris, welcome to our show.
Hi, John. Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Lori Harkness joins us by phone as well, Director of the Aurora Community Care Center. It's part of the Veterans Administration of the Connecticut Healthcare System. Lori, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're going to focus most of our attention on what you talked about with veterans and others yesterday, but I'd like to get a little bit from both of you about the impact of the Fort Hood shooting on the work that you do. Chris, whenever we hear another story about a high-profile suicide or a shooting, something like this happening, I know that it has a lot of people thinking about mental health care for our veterans. What exactly are you thinking on this week when we have this tragedy in Fort Hood?
Well, John, I think it's very difficult for us to speculate on any one specific incident, including Fort Hood. However, I think it does reinforce the importance of, as a community, meaning a true partnership between the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, state, local, and nonprofit organizations such as my agency, the Community Renewal Team, on how we coordinate services. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has done a really good job of putting resources into the community, such as mental health services, substance abuse services, housing services, many of which Dr. Harkness and her team run out of the Aurora Community Care Center in West Haven. They do a tremendous job, and there's such a variety of services that are available to meet the needs of veterans. And I think what the most important thing for us to focus on, in which the whole idea behind the conference that my agency hosted yesterday, was that these services are coordinated in a fashion that is both effective and efficient. Because, you know, it's almost like you can have, you can throw as much money at a problem as you want. However, if it's not effectively implemented, you're not going to get the outcomes and the impact that we all need.
Lori Harkness, I'm wondering if you can respond to this. What do you think whenever you hear another one of these stories, it brings into really stark relief what is happening with an awful lot of our veterans, the very, very high suicide rate, a lot of the behaviors that we see after the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. What does it make you think of?
Is we need to realize that combat and war changes people, and that some people, not all, come back carrying the invisible wounds of their service. It's easy to offer services and support to veterans that have physical disabilities, but for those that come back with readjustment issues that may or may not be PTSD, it's really important that we create an environment that, without any stigma, these veterans can reach out and get the support and services that they need. Is that we are offering more and more mental health services, medical services, while people are in the military. But I think that we need to make it all right to reach out for services, all right to get help. And important, we must not forget the support that families need as their loved ones come home, and they're different, is that we need to make sure that we treat the whole person, the whole family.
And there's a, as I mentioned in the introduction, there's a lot we don't know about the role of post-traumatic stress in this one individual's life, but we do know that it is something that is affecting an awful lot of people who are coming back from war. We also have heard stories, Lori, in the last few days of a number of servicemen and women attempting to get services at Fort Hood or Fort Bliss, where he was previously, and waiting in line, not able to get those services. What can you tell us about the ability for veterans or active duty military to get mental health services when they need them?
I think that DOD is going to need to examine whether that's true or not. And, you know, if they need to, they need to offer more resources and make them more accessible and readily available. You know, we'll know over time, you know, the reality of the situation. I can tell you here at VA Connecticut is that we do not have a waiting list for people who need mental health services. When the veterans come in or when we reach them in the community and engage them into the VA system of care, they can readily get their issues addressed.
And John?
Yes, please.
I can certainly second that. I mean, my agency, CRT, operates a lot of services which are funded through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, including a program called SSVF, or Support Services for Veteran Families. And over the past 2+ years, we've served over 400 veterans and their families, either preventing them from lapsing into homelessness or rapidly rehousing them. And we work with an inter-service delivery approach, team approach with VA Connecticut Healthcare. And I can tell you in all of our experiences working with Lori's area with the Aurora Community Care Center, clinicians, mental health professionals, and support staff are readily available. And as a team, we take the approach, as Lori had indicated, working holistically with veterans so that we're not only looking at siloed basis of services, it's how we treat the whole individual as well as the entire family.
We're talking with Chris McCluskey and Lori Harkness on the heels of a conference in Hartford about veterans issues and how we provide services for our veterans, of course, coming the same week as this Fort Hood shooting. If you have thoughts, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Paul in Plymouth. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live. Paul, are you there? I'm going to put Paul on hold, and hopefully we'll be able to get his call back. I'm going to go to Derek, who's calling from Windsor. Hello, Derek. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Derek, I mean, John, great program. First of all, I think it's insane that in 2014, the question that you're asking is a question that needs to be asked. These folks are the folks that put their life out there on the line to keep us all here safe in America. And these kind of situations should be addressed long ago. So in my mind, it just goes to show that the government does not really care about nobody. And another thing that needs to be addressed, John, I understand that it's a third of veterans that are homeless. And your panel need to be honest. I talk to veterans. They are saying that they take care of these situations. If you talk to veterans one-on-one, you hear a different thing. So they need to be honest and come right up front and address this situation. I would never serve in the American Army.
Hmm.
Not because I wouldn't want to serve my country, but because of the treatment these folks get when they come back. It's a shame and disgrace in America, the richest country in the world. John, that's all I have to say.
Derek, it's always good to hear from you. Thank you very much. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Chris, I'll put to you the second part of what Derek said. A lot of veterans are coming back and finding it hard to find a place to live. What did we learn yesterday at your conference, and what can we say right now about the status of finding appropriate housing for people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I would disagree with the caller as far as the availability of housing services. I mean, I'll go back to 2010. In 2010, I attended a National Coalition of Homeless Veterans Conference. And in that conference, the keynote speaker was Secretary Eric Shinseki of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And when the general was speaking, or I should say the secretary was speaking, he talked about, in my opinion, this grandiose plan about eradicating homelessness amongst veterans within 5 years. And I sat back, relatively new to the service industry for veterans, and I said, what is this guy talking about? He actually thinks we're going to end homelessness amongst veterans in 5 years. But then when I really started to ponder it and think more in depth about what the general was saying, is he was saying it's unacceptable for anyone to accept that the men and women that are putting their lives on the line in fighting for our country could be homeless even a day on the streets of our nation. And with that, not only my agency, but a host of service providers, not only in the state of Connecticut, but in the entire nation, have dedicated ourselves to addressing this issue. Within Connecticut, I can speak to pretty well, and Lori, who oversees the entire homeless team at Arrera Community Care Center for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in West Haven and the Newington campus, can speak more about, I think, the numbers and the accessibility out there. But when we look at the number of available beds and the utilization of those beds, we have one. We were talking yesterday in the conference about reentry services. One of the housing options that my agency administers is a house called Veterans Crossing. And Veterans Crossing is a grant per diem program, which is funded through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, to provide housing for individuals exiting the Department of Corrections that are veterans. We've been operating that program since 2010, and I'm proud to say we have an 89% successful discharge rate. And then somebody's going to ask, well, what do you mean by that, Chris? What I mean by that is 89% of the veterans that access our services are entering into permanent housing, either subsidized or unsubsidized. Now, the other important thing is, how do we measure success? Well, we also measure success with veterans that were involved in a criminal justice system, with reintegrating them not only back into the community, but reintegrating them back into their families. Because in many cases, these relationships were severed because of drug and alcohol addiction or their involvement in a criminal justice section. And then, as I had articulated earlier, we have the supportive services for veterans' families. The Community Renewal Team was the first provider in the state of Connecticut to offer those services. In the first year alone, we served 178 homeless veterans, or prevented the veterans from relapsing into homelessness. Subsequent to that, in last year, we served over 200 veteran families, and this year we're on pace to serve over 200 again. And we're just one service provider in the state of Connecticut. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to not only the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs about making these resources available, but specifically in the state. When I attend national conferences and I hear what's happening in other states, I'm proud to say that I'm providing services in partnership with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in the state of Connecticut, because I hear what we're doing in the state, and we're well more advanced than other areas of the country.
I want to get to our caller, Paul, who we tried to join with a bit before. Paul's in Plymouth. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Glad to be here in Connecticut talking about the most important issues. We're talking about preventive care versus clinical care. The clinical care that has been met out from Department of Defense. Now, don't forget that these veterans, before they become veterans, are treated for various disorders or physical ailments. And what happens is the clinical approach is one of drug the patient and put them back in so that they can wreck their body. And so it's a part of the operation of military. And these counselors and people who come forward and say they want to help vets, they don't understand the dynamic. They don't want to step on the toes and bite the hand that feeds them, because the federal government funds a lot of these counseling and a lot of these veteran programs.
But, Paul, I'm wondering, are you a veteran yourself?
Yes, I've studied veterans' issues before I went in the service in 1972, and I served in the U.S. Navy. Now, my mother was a veteran. My father served in the U.S. Navy as well. And when mom wanted to stick with VA health care, institutionally, they would rather have the older vet or the vet that could be eligible for disability go that route, so that the VA funding shifts into another funding entity. So in one situation, you have medical people that are there that are supposed to be for the well-being of the patient. But what they are doing is they are thinking institutionally of funding.
And what I'm going to do is, let me put that to Lori Harkness, who's been listening in. And thank you, Paul, for your phone call very much.
Paul, first of all, thank you for your service and your family's services. That you make a very, very important point, which is it is really important that we as providers of care understand the military culture and military values, because in order to support and offer the appropriate services, we must understand the military experience. And the best person to understand the military experience, of course, is another veteran. That's why over half of my staff here at the Herrera Center are veterans themselves. The experience of your mom's generation and the Vietnam veterans, we learned a lot about how to better treat our returning soldiers. We learned a lot about how to offer the appropriate services to veterans coming home with readjustment issues and post-traumatic stress disorder. And that now for our returning soldiers, that they're getting the most up-to-date, state-of-the-art, evidence-based practices to help them learn to live with PTSD, learn to live with TBI. But veterans don't heal in institutions. Veterans heal learning to live in the community, so that the VA has moved many millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to the community to support veterans living in their own houses, in their own apartments, whatever, so that my staff spend most of the time in the community wrapping around the services that the veterans need in order to successfully be living in the community. We also know that how you spend your day is important, so that we have a whole array of employment specialists that work with employers in the community and veterans to match veterans to employment opportunities that meet their needs and wishes. And then when you're doing something productive, you feel better about yourself, and your PTSD isn't the only important thing about your life. It's an important part, but it's not the only thing. So, and then most of the veterans we serve are still elderly. When I say elderly, and I'm 63, are 55 or older. So I don't mean elderly, but I mean Vietnam-age era veterans are still the bulk of the veterans that we're serving. Our World War II veterans are dying off. But we have a bimodal distribution, and we have a growing number of young Iraq and Afghan soldiers and Gulf War soldiers that are coming for services, and that we're trying to help them get the support they need while they're staying in the community.
We want to hear a voice of a veteran who was speaking during a veterans panel at yesterday's conference about his post-military incarceration experience, something he says resulted from not having proper services to treat his PTSD.
I was incarcerated for a short term of 120 days. I unfortunately had a third DUI. That DUI was largely triggered through a lot of alcohol dependence at the time. I tried to receive treatment for PTSD since 2003. Unfortunately, due to policy at the time and the lack of awareness by the Department of Defense at the time for policies at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and treating PTSD, I was unfortunately unable to get that treatment. So trying to self-treat, I drank a lot, trying to sleep, and that led to DUIs and other mental health issues, which fortunately I've had the opportunity to see how other parts of the government work being presented to the VA when considering options of, let's say, finality.
That's one of the veterans speaking at a veterans panel that was held yesterday. This panel is what we're talking about here in the program. And before we run low on time, as we talk with Chris McCluskey and Lori Harkness, Chris, that voice, I'm sure one of many that we heard yesterday. We've heard from a few callers already who are suggesting that the government, whether it's the state, the federal government, just isn't doing enough for our veterans. We hear voices like that. Do you feel confident that we are doing enough for people like the voice we just heard in order to make sure that they can cope with coming back from war, find places to live, and also stay out of jail, stay out of incarceration?
Well, I mean, I can speak to the local perspective in the state of Connecticut. I don't feel comfortable with any confidence speaking nationally without having any data in front of me. However, in the state of Connecticut, going back to the former caller as far as resources being provided in our community and funding through the VA. Look, my agency has been in existence for over 50 years, and our whole mission is to assist people that are in poverty. and in this case also veterans. So we certainly stand by all of our services that we've provided. We're an agency that's focused on outcomes, and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs hold us accountable to outcomes. With an 89% successful discharge rate in our Veterans Crossing program and our accessibility with the Veterans Administration staff. And it's not just my agency. There's a number of other agencies, and also the Connecticut Heroes Project. I'd like to mention them. They're an outstanding agency who are continuing to advocate for the needs of veterans in the state of Connecticut, working with the governor's office, nonprofit providers, the Department of Corrections, Lori's team. I feel that in the state of Connecticut, resources are available, and the most important thing that we need to do moving forward is to ensure that veterans understand eligibility criteria, what it is to be a veteran. There's many veterans that don't self-identify as veterans because the questions may be asked wrong. What we learned yesterday, and we spoke about a lot, was that when we're engaging veterans at intake and assessment, to ask the question, have you any military experience, as opposed to, are you a veteran? It's a big difference between what the response is going to be from that veteran.
And this is something that we've heard for years, is that there really are a lot of resources out there for veterans. It's just hard to align the veterans with the resources, making sure everyone knows what is out there. I want to give quickly, before I let you go, Chris, I believe there's a veterans crisis line at 1-800-273-8255. I think we've given that out on the air before. 1-800-273-8255. This forum, this panel discussion that came together yesterday, put together by a community renewal team sponsored by the Middle Atlantic States Correctional Association and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. If you want to find out more about Veterans Affairs here in Connecticut, you can go to our website, WNPR.org, and look for The Coming Home Project, which is a series by our own Lucy Nalpathanchil. I want to thank Chris McCloskey, Vice President of Housing and Community Services at Community Renewal Team. Thank you, Chris, for your time. I appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks also to Lori Harkness, Director of the Arrera Community Care Center, part of the Veterans Administration of the Connecticut Healthcare System. We'll speak with you again, Lori, and keep up the good work for veterans.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we're going to talk about a new tax plan that's been floated by the Connecticut Speaker of the House. It's something that not a lot of colleges are too happy about. We're going to find out from one college president what he thinks. That's next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A few weeks back, I hosted a panel discussion at Goodwin College about a regional collaboration amongst Connecticut towns. It's an issue that's been the main focus of Brendan Sharkey, Connecticut Speaker of the House. But he used this event to talk about another plan that he has called Reverse Pilot. It would be a big change to the way tax money flows in the state. He says the state's nonprofits should pay taxes to the towns where they reside and start a conversation about their roles in the community.
There's a lot of institutions that are taking a lot of heat right now for the fact that they are not engaging in this conversation with their local towns, and they're feeling that heat. So this is really a culmination of a lot of years of frustration that they knew was coming, and at some level they knew was coming.
Institutions like colleges would have to make the case for why they should pay less in taxes and then go to the state legislature for relief. It's basically a reverse of the current pilot program. Pilot stands for payment in lieu of taxes. Now, not surprisingly, many colleges and hospitals aren't too happy about the idea. Here to talk about it is Mark Scheinberg, who is president of Goodwin College, our host for that panel discussion. He's joined us on the program before. Mark, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, John.
So I spoke at length with the speaker about his plan. We talked about some of the pros and the cons. Whether or not this is something that's going to happen this or next legislative session is maybe not what we're talking about right now, but it is an idea that he's floated. And at the core of it is this idea that the big institutions like colleges and hospitals that reside in towns don't pay taxes, and therefore the towns suffer. He says you should have to pay full taxes and then go back to the state and help recoup some of that, maybe negotiate with the towns on your tax rate. What do you think is wrong with his program?
Oh, my. First of all, he doesn't say that in the global sense that you're saying, because he doesn't say that to the state institutions who are exempt, and because if they had to pay taxes, that money would have to come from the state. And the state's not suggesting that.
You mean the University of Connecticut, the Central Connecticut State University, that sort of thing?
That sort of thing. And so I understand that. He's also not saying that the kind of college that people think about when they think about private colleges in Connecticut would be part of this either. For example, Yale University is a nonprofit, and that is actually enshrined in our own constitution. So Yale would not be part of this, nor would Connecticut College, Wesleyan, or Trinity, who are also part of that group. And so I would guess also he could not probably require the religious institutions to do this because there are exemptions around religious institutions. And so you end up with a group that's left that this thing really does work itself around. And so right off the face of it, it's sort of an unfair program for those colleges that don't happen to be parochial nature or don't happen to be state institutions.
So one of the things he's saying is that towns that house these institutions suffer because they don't have the same tax base as other communities. Now, everyone should know, and this is something important, and it's interesting that you're here. Goodwin College used to be a for-profit school. You used to be a tax-paying institution in East Hartford. Can you just talk about that and how that changed?
Sure. Goodwin College was an institution that I helped to grow. I was one of the founders of the institution. And we actually took the whole place nonprofit about 10, 12 years ago for the purpose of making a gift to our community. And so for me personally, quite honestly, when colleges are characterized as these large institutions that are, as the speaker has said, not your parents' nonprofit, and implying that that is somehow money making is offensive because I gave away that asset personally that was worth many millions of dollars. That was done because it was meant to be a gift and a legacy to the community. So even as a nonprofit, Goodwin College is the second largest taxpayer in East Hartford, which will blow people's minds sometimes. We pay a massive amount in taxes because we do many things that are not purely collegiate in nature. But we also, according to CERC, who did a study for us, have provided $1.3 billion in new income into the East Hartford region since we've been there 10 years ago.
Before we talk about the economic development piece of this, which you just mentioned, talk about the taxes that you do pay, just so we help understand. What taxes do you pay to the town of East Hartford?
Well, we have taken our neighborhood in our area and we have stabilized it. We've actually bought a lot of houses and fixed them up, and they continue to be rented out to families, some of them low income. But they are rentals. Main Street in East Hartford as well is an area that is across from the new Pratt & Whitney, and we have bought properties there that we have rehabbed and rented out as an economic development support for the town, which also helps us. It's self-serving as well. We want to have our town be strong and healthy. But that's all taxpaying, and it's properly taxpaying.
One of the things that the speaker is talking about is this idea that if we flip this on its head, if Pilot Now works where you get fully taxed at Goodwin College, you would negotiate with the town on a tax rate that makes sense for you, given all this economic development, given the fact that you've invested in the community. East Hartford obviously doesn't want to see you leave or close, not have as many people working there. So they would negotiate with you a tax rate that made some sense, and then you'd go to the state legislature and get the rest. Why doesn't that work?
Well, first of all, when you're an institution, you are located in a town with lots of buildings. Institutions are places with buildings in this case. We're not going to move. We're not like Pfizer, and we're not going to tell somebody, you either give us a break or we're leaving. We're not leaving. We're part of the community. We're a community-based organization. And so the concept of us having that sort of flexibility isn't there. In East Hartford, we have a 45 mill rate. It's one of the highest in the state. The town right now is begging the state for relief because they have a deficit in the town of somewhere in the $3 or $4 million range. If I were going to negotiate with that town, what choice does that mayor have but to ask us to take on some of the issues that she's dealing with? The mayors are in a desperate situation. They're in an untenable situation. It's terribly unfair for them to be in a role where they are in this position. I think that the truth of it is that they need money wherever they can get it, and that to put that on the backs of their institutions in town is not fair. No, they don't want us to close. Of course they don't want us to close. We're not going to move. But in the edge of that is a negotiation that's really not a negotiation at all. I've talked to many mayors, and they make it very clear if they can come up with this money, it's new money. Now, if we go back to the legislature and ask for this money, well, they haven't funded Pilot as it is now.
Pilot is funded around 33 cents in the dollar.
Is that
the latest number? Meaning that when the towns and cities now go and ask for that payment in lieu of taxes, they're only getting about 33 cents on the dollar that would be there if they were able to tax Goodwin College. So they're not really getting it from the state. I'm assuming, given the state's fiscal situation, that number's not going up anytime soon.
Exactly. And it hasn't been fully funded for as long as I can remember. And this is where it's important. The kind of numbers that we're talking about, when we've done some pro formas internally, is a number that runs akin to us of about 20% of our entire budget, 15% of our entire budget. It's a number that's large enough that that money has to come from somewhere. It can't come from our students because we work with a demographic that looks much like an urban community college, where they're all working adults at my school. If we had to find 15% more money, you'd in theory have to increase the tuition, but they can't pay it. We haven't increased tuition at Goodwin College in 4 years because we do not believe that our students can take on any more debt or take on any more expense. So we're doing this by keeping things very, very tight and close. In one fell swoop, if this thing were to happen, we'd have to figure out where to get money that we don't believe we can get from our students. That's dangerous.
We're talking with Mark Scheinberg. He's the president of Goodwin College. We're talking about a tax plan floated by the Connecticut Speaker of the House, Brendan Sharkey. We spoke with him a few weeks ago about this plan, which he calls reverse pilot. If you have thoughts, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Wayne in West Hartford. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I really wanted to thank President Scheinberg for making the case for private colleges. I think that it is the most viable industry Connecticut has had. It really puts Connecticut on the map and brings people into the state to spend money here. And I find it very disturbing that after Malloy has, just succeeded at demolishing some of the public colleges, that now somehow by coincidence we're going after the private ones. I think we really have to step back and take a look at the big picture and not monkey with a good thing.
Wayne, before I let you go, one quick question, and this is the point that Brendan Sharkey has, is where do the towns which are struggling to pay the bills, where do they get the money? If they house a couple of these big institutions, they're not getting the tax money that some other communities are. They say, we need to find this money to, you know, build the roads, to have police, to make sure the town runs okay.
There are a lot of different formulas the towns can use. What's going on here is just people see these big institutions. People have a certain resentment of the so-called elitism of these colleges, and they just pick up the torches and pitchforks and start running.
Wayne, thank you very much. One of the things that I asked Wayne that I'll ask you about that comes up an awful lot is when you have any sort of institution, doesn't have to be a huge one, in a community that has a lot of services connected. There's roads, there's police, there's emergency, there's all that stuff that the town has to pay for. And obviously that has to be a bit of a partnership. Maybe you can address that issue because a lot of towns are going to say, look, we're footing the bill to make sure people can get to Goodwin College. They need to help us, you know, rebuild those roads.
First of all, I think there's a lot of what you're saying has a lot of merit. I have to approach it in two different ways. First of all, yes, colleges need to do what they can in support of their towns. In our case, we have actually gone ourselves for grants to help the roads that you're talking about. In our case, we did a study, and the crime in our area has gone in half in the last 5 years since we've been there because we have our own police force that also supplements what the town does. But you alluded to it when the speaker was here that the real problem is that you have two small pockets of places that we call towns in Connecticut. When I was at the legislative session, I heard that in New London, that's a town of 6 square miles. They have 3 large institutions there. That eats up a lot of 6 square miles. I got to believe in stores, UConn has to eat up a huge part of the store's landmass. Those smaller places in size don't have the ability to do other development to offset and find new tax money when a large institution is there. The problem, actually, which the speaker is a total proponent of, is a better sense of regionalization. To put all the weight on this on small towns in Connecticut is a very difficult thing for those towns. I can certainly feel for those towns. And so, pilot funds is one way to deal with it. If they fully funded pilot, you would not see this as an issue for mayors. But shy of that, to regionalize some of the and weigh some of the costs of this would be the smartest long-term solution.
Well, so let's talk about that before I let you go. And this is a very important thing. This idea of regionalization is something that we talk about an awful lot, but it has so many historical roadblocks. How will we ever get to this point? If you could wave a magic wand, Mark, and you could make this just work a little bit better, how would this work? Would East Hartford, Hartford and West Hartford all be one big town? Would you work more closely with neighboring communities on development rights? Would you allow towns to tax in a different way? What would you do?
This isn't fascinating. Connecticut would be, the entire state would be one county in most other states.
Sure.
And it would probably be all looked at in one piece instead of the number of towns that we have now. If I had a magic wand, I would actually strengthen county government. The MDC, when it was created, was thought to be something like that. I think that so many of our services are duplicated so many times, it's not possible to have any economy of scale. And that's where the savings are. That's where you actually take issues like Chef O'Neill lawsuit, issues around racial isolation, issues around economic isolation, and you could actually have a means to work with it without trying to figure it out one town at a time.
A last thing for you before I let you go. If indeed Speaker Sharkey's plan, as he's floated out there, becomes law at a certain point, what do you think it means to you at Goodwin College? As you said, you've built a lot. You've gone from being a for-profit to being a nonprofit. You've obviously employed a lot of people. You've changed the complete complexion of a part of East Hartford that didn't really have anything there before. You're not going to pick up and move. I'm not sure what you're going to do. What do you do if this happens?
Actually, my board is in a defensive posture right now. On the offhand case that this happens, because we're new, we don't have a large endowment, we don't have a lot of big donors, we have to think about whether or not we can survive. I'm not being dramatic. The fact of it is that the only kinds of schools that can survive in this situation are online institutions who have no facilities, who don't have to pay anybody property taxes for what they have. If you're going to do things with people in a classroom, one student at a time, in a very personal way, schools like that don't have a future in this model.
Mm. And, of course, there's been a lot of bad press around for-profit schools around the country and the way they operate. It seems as though there's been a move away from the for-profit school model actually being something that people want to go to or that communities want to accept and support.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, isn't it important to realize that we're seen as a community resource and a community-based resource in all ways until now, when the money is just so dear that we're willing to step over that for this purpose?
Well, we love talking about tax policy here and where we live. I know it's not necessarily the most exciting thing to a lot of our listeners, but it's really important in the way institutions like yours operate and certainly the way the legislature operates. So I appreciate you coming in and talking about it. Mark Scheinberg is president of Goodwin College. Very good to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, John.
When we come back, we're going to talk about parking. That's another thing we talk about a lot here on Where We Live. It might be counterintuitive, but the more parking spaces you have, it might mean less revenue for your town. A new study from UConn says just that. We'll find out more coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up Monday, over the past 2,500 years or so, the world's urban water systems have undergone three revolutions. According to author David Sedlak, population growth and climate change could mean a fourth is on its way. On our show, Sedlak discusses his most recent book, Water 4.0. Also, we'll talk to a West Virginia Public Radio reporter to get an update on the effects of the Elk River chemical spill. I hope you can join us for a water conversation coming up on Monday's Where We Live. When we talk about urban design issues here, it always seems to come back to parking. Some people say there's not enough parking, or what's there is too expensive. Many urban planners, meanwhile, say there's plenty of parking, and making any more would just force more people into cars and off of public transportation. A new study looks at six cities and the impact on their economies, and the suggestion is that cities might be hurting their chances of economic strength by building more parking lots. WNPR's Alan Yu reported on this for WNPR.org this week, and we got lots and lots of response to this, including maybe your response. You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we talk with our friend Norman Garrick. He's Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut about this parking study. Norm, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me back.
So tell me about the six cities that you studied here. What were you looking at and what did you find?
Well, we did a study a few years ago where we looked at 13 cities around the country. We selected cities that had been developed in the area before cars were were prominent, and we wanted just to see what happened to these cities as they tried to accommodate cars. What we found was that in a lot of places, that there was a trend that cities with the most parking also had less people and less jobs. And, you know, that didn't prove the point that we were didn't show distinctly the point that we really needed to get at was there a cause and effect. So what we went back and did was to look at changes in six of those cities over the last 50 or so years. And in that study, we found that those cities that increased parking the most had the least growth in terms of jobs and in terms of people.
These cities, and if you go to WNPR.org and you look at Alan Yu's report, we have a graph here. Arlington, Berkeley, Cambridge, Hartford, Lowell, and New Haven. Now, it's a bit not surprising, Norman, that towns like Hartford, Lowell, and New Haven have had a whole lot of parking, and those are cities that have not thrived. Why did you pick the other towns, and what have they done right in your mind?
We picked all the cities based on the change in car use over the last 50 years. So we wanted cities that had little or no car use. In fact, Cambridge had a decrease in car use over the last 60 years. And we also wanted to compare them to cities that had a huge increase in car use. One of the things that struck us at the start of the study was that it was very surprising that there were American cities with a decrease in car use that were using cars at a lower rate than they did in the 1960s. So that was the starting point. And a lot of people now say that you can't compare Hartford to Cambridge. One of the things that struck us is that in 1960, Hartford and Cambridge looked a lot like each other in terms of economic development, in terms of vibrancy, etc. And the divergence that causes the reaction that they can't be compared now is happened over the last 60 years.
Now, there's a lot of things about parking that we've discussed in the past and some things that I think are really interesting. One thing is about how we actually make a parking strategy. I know that for Alan's story, he talked with Donald Shoup. He's a professor of urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. He studies parking policies. Here's what he had to say about parking pricing.
I don't think you can really greatly reform a city's parking policy unless you get the price of on-street parking right. And by right, I mean not too high or not too low, sort of like the Goldilocks principle of parking prices, that if the price is too high for curb parking, you know, the meter rate, suppose it's $4 an hour, it could be that, you know, half the spaces will be empty, and that stores will lose business and the spaces won't be used, and customers won't have opportunities to park and walk around. But if the price is too low, say suppose it's 25 cents an hour in a congested area, then all the spaces will be full, and drivers will circle the block hunting for a cheap curb space. And that happens in a lot of cities. That there have been studies done over the past 80 years and on four continents. And they found that in congested areas, about a third of the cars in congested traffic were hunting for an underpriced curb parking space. So San Francisco and L.A. are trying to set the right price of curb parking, which means about one or two open spaces on every block. If you can see one or two open spaces on a block, the price is just right.
I find this interesting. Again, that's Donald Shoup, who studies parking. Norm Garrick, this idea of parking spaces on the street versus surface parking lots versus parking garages, this is the sort of thing that cities are trying to tune just right. Of the cities you studied, how are they doing? Are they getting any of these models right?
Well, I think the cities like Cambridge does get a lot right. For example, so Donald is focusing on the cost to the users. What our study focused on was the tax implication. In Hartford, the tax rate for parking garage, the amount that parking garages are taxed, is lower than any other use, like residential, like commercial. It's also lower than in Cambridge. The exact opposite is true in Cambridge. They tax parking at a much higher rate, parking garages. And it seems that this money is then used to subsidize residential tax. I was really surprised to see that the residential tax rates are lower than in Hartford.
And that's really what you're talking about there. So you make the parking that is there a little bit more expensive to at least get in the business of. You raise the tax rate of the parking lot, and then you put the tax money that you get from the parking into subsidizing the housing tax rate. It means more people living there, fewer people driving there.
That's exactly right. All of those elements are coming together in one plan versus what we see in a city like Hartford.
Now, also in a city like Hartford, we see the rise of the surface parking lot. That's the usage that I think your study and much of your work over the course of your career, Norman, has really proven to be the worst use of urban spaces. The parking lot that's just one empty space. It's parking a lot of cars. It's not necessarily giving too much back to the economy.
That's true. And again, the tax incentive in Hartford actually encourages the taking down buildings because if you are in a struggling city already where you might not be able to get a top use for a building, then it becomes really attractive to get the income from parking, especially since you're not paying much of a tax on that land. So you might remember the case a few years ago when there was a plan to remove a building on Asylum that was, at the time it was hosting a piano store, and there was a plan to take it down and replace it with a parking lot.
We're talking with Norman Garrick. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. We have just a moment or so to talk more about parking and this study that he's done. You can find out more at WNPR.org. So what is your prescription for cities like Hartford or New Haven? What's a better parking policy moving forward? If you could choose it, Norman, what would you do?
Well, a lot of cities have removed minimum parking requirements related with different use. The latest one is Nashville, Tennessee. But cities have also looked at pricing, and Donald Shoup referred to the plan in San Francisco. But there are also cities that are addressing the issues of the differential taxes. For example, in Montreal, they've put on a particular tax rate, an extra tax rate on each parking space, so that lowers the disincentive or the incentive for turning lots into parking.
And that first thing that you mentioned, the number of spaces that need to come along with new development, this idea that many cities require you to build a certain amount of spaces when you build new housing, you're saying that's something that could change and force down the number of spaces in a town.
In fact, it's more than just changing from a minimum, but some cities actually say that you can only build a certain amount. So they actually went in the reverse direction, and they have a maximum amount that you can build that is associated with each square footage.
If you want to find out more about this, we've got a report from WNPR's Alan Yu at WNPR.org. It's already generated a fair amount of conversation both there and on Facebook, and you can find it at WNPR.org right now. Norman Garrick is Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut. Good to talk to you about parking once again, Norm.
Thank you, John.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to our interns Skylar Magnoli, Anna Novak, and Jane Ashley. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.